This program is brought to you by Fresh FM.
Hello and welcome. I'm Galen Pound and you're listening to Top Writers. Today I am talking to fantasy author Belinda Mellor about her Sylvana series. But first we're going to hear from Dana.
This is Dana Wensley and you're listening to Top Writers. I want to take a few moments to talk about freedom of speech. I'm the freedom of speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is a worldwide organisation that promotes literature and freedom of expression. In other series, I've spoken to you about the decline in freedom of speech worldwide. You can listen to these following the links to my podcasts on www.topwriters.co.nz. Whether it's abroad with Turkish prosecutors detaining the editor of Turkey's most prominent opposition newspaper, just days after the government issued decrees restricting more than a dozen media outlets, dismissing more than 1,000 academics, or here in New Zealand, when the group called the European Students Association at Auckland University was closed down after threats to its members and accusations of racism, freedom of speech is declining worldwide. While we don't have overt forms of restrictions on free speech in New Zealand, what we do have is the perceived lack of democratic involvement in all levels of government. For those interested in free speech in New Zealand and its relationship with political institutions, Complacent Nation by Gavin Ellis is a must read. Ellis is a senior lecturer in media, film and television at the University of Auckland. He's also a former editor-in-chief of the New Zealand Herald. And the chapter on the decline of the news media in New Zealand should be compulsory reading for anyone interested in free speech, the media and government. Complacent Nation sets out the big picture, drawing the reader along the path that leads to the ultimate conclusion. There are many ways freedom of speech can be eroded in society, and New Zealand has become complacent about the continuing erosion of the right to know what the government is doing. What we find is a media that is struggling to keep alive. Writers often no longer paid for opinion pieces, so quality is diminishing. It's a vicious cycle because the less value people find in the mainstream news media, the less they pay for papers and the more pushed reporters are to cover stories in a way that does them justice. There are also serious questions in New Zealand about how free public servants are to critique and or publicly contradict government policy. This relates to another issue. How free are elected members of local and national government to speak out about policies they do not agree with? In the past decade, codes of conduct and communication policies have become increasingly more restrictive. They dictate how and when public sector employees can communicate with the media and require multiple levels of authorization before such communications could take place. Critics argue that the changes were designed to prevent the public release of information that contradicted government positions. In 2016, researcher and academic Catherine Strong from Massey University published a report entitled Local Authority Code of Conduct, Anti-Conflict and Anti-Media. Her report examined code of conduct for councils around New Zealand. She rated them in terms of how they allowed elected officials to communicate with the media. The appendix of her report outlines the wording restrictions. Some use standard local government New Zealand wording, others amend it with strong anti-criticism wording, effectively gagging local councillors from speaking out contrary to council opinion. What interests me is that Catherine Strong ties this restriction and information directly with the lack of voter turnout. She argues that this filtering of information creates an apathy. She argues that controversy is a valuable drive to encouraging audiences to relate to an issue. In other words, by restricting the ability of our officials to speak out and express opposition views, an increasing number of people have lost interest in local government. This is especially true for voters aged 18 to 24 years who are now less likely than ever to vote. This translates to a low voter turnout, as we have seen in the latest local body elections, and it's a worrying trend and one we must seek to overcome this year as we face the general election on 23rd of September. These issues are just the tip of the iceberg. The simple fact is we simply don't have a handle on how much information is restricted in New Zealand. PEN is interested in a wide range of issues relating to freedom of speech and how it affects our democratic rights. We will be monitoring these developments this year. If you want to find out more about what PEN does and how you can be involved, follow the links on the New Zealand Society of Authors website to PEN, or contact me, Dana Wensley, at pen@nzauthors.org.nz.
I'm Galen Pound and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is Belinda Mellor, author of the Sylvana fantasy novels. Welcome to Top Writers, Belinda.
Thank you, Galen.
You began writing at an early age. At 5, you won a school award for creative expression, then a similar award at age 10. And then in your 20s, you were the inaugural winner of the Ian St. James Literary Award. What are your memories of your reactions to these awards?
I have no real memories of the school ones, apart from being delighted, especially the second one, because I think the prize was my very first Tolkien book, which was his poetry book, Tom Bombadil, which started me on my real love affair with his works. Obviously, the Ian St. James Award, I was older, and I have a huge memory of actually dancing around our unfurnished living room with my mother when that letter arrived to say that I already knew I was in the long list, but to hear I was in the last 12 and was going to be published. Yes, that was amazing.
Now, didn't you get a lot of publicity as being an Irish author and you'd only been in Ireland a week?
Yes, we had just moved what I'd call home, although I had never lived in Ireland, but I always thought of it as home. My mother's family were from Wexford, with very strong links to that town. Her uncle had been mayor, and her parents had met there. And we had no furniture. I think our furniture was on its way, and we had no telephone, and we didn't know very many people, obviously. So this letter came and saying we were very happy, and then suddenly I was being embraced by not just the local papers, but national papers. Even it made the 6 o'clock news, national news, when I went to Dublin to collect the award. And it even led to a job offer from a local theatre company. So was for a local magazine to start with, which was part of a theatre company, and I ended up being part of that for years. So it was a huge turning point. And certainly, yes, described as a local author and an Irish author was my dream, I suppose, always. I always wanted to be Irish and I always wanted to be an author. So there you are. I got both.
So when did you make the conscious decision that you wanted to be a writer?
I don't think I ever did. I think I always was. I wrote poetry, probably really bad poetry, but I wrote poetry from a very early age in pencil. I still have some penciled ones that my father wrote over for me in biro so they wouldn't fade. I wrote my first chapter book when I was about 7, The Adventures of Bonnie Bunny, and Minimus Goes to the Moon. Minimus was a mouse. Again, in pencil, in a school notebook. And I was a voracious reader. I never didn't write. I don't think I ever thought I'm going to be a writer. But various opportunities came up to earn some money doing it. And it just became a lifestyle, I suppose, on and off.
So why did you choose fantasy as your preferred genre?
Again, I'm not sure I chose fantasy. I've always loved mythology and I've always understood the role of storytelling in human history. And the first stories, apart from people talking about their own prowess out hunting mammoths, I suspect the first stories were all folklore, mythology, all those sort of fantasy stories, as we call them, are the oldest form of storytelling. And I loved as a small child, I loved fairy stories, and by seven I was reading C.S. Lewis, and by early secondary school, which as I went to school in England was 10, 11 years old, I think I discovered Greek mythology. I'd always been very aware of Irish folklore, and this is how human experience is explained. So it wasn't that I wanted to make things up or escape, but I think I always understood that you can tell about true and important things through that medium, where fantasy is the vehicle, and you don't have to worry about mundane constraints. You can change the world so that the heart of the story becomes the most important thing.
Right, now, as an adult, you're best known for the Sylvanas series, which have also received awards, the 5-star review award from Reader's Favourite Book Review and Awards, and last year you were a finalist in the adult fiction category Wishing Shelf Awards.
That's right, yes.
Can you please tell me a little bit about this series? There are how many books so far? Two?
Two. There was supposed to be just one. It was a story. I call it a fantasy biography. It's the story of one man. It just grew so large, it actually turned into two books. And there was a natural division because there's a few-year gap. The second half focused a lot more on the son of the main character, although it's the main character's life. So, yes, it just was a story that came to me, I have to admit, over 20 years ago. And I just daydreamed it. And I lived it in my head for quite a while, and then I had to write it down. I think it was about 120 pages in its original incarnation. And it's just been growing gently over the years until I thought, I have to stop. I have to actually say this is finished now.
So the story's about Fabian.
Yes.
And he falls in love with the Sylvani? Vani, Cassandra.
Oh, Sylvana, it's as singular as
yeah,
Sylvana.
Yeah, yeah.
Cassandra.
Yeah. And it's about capturing her heart and living in an...
It is. It's more... He falls in love with the idea. He loves the woods. He loves the forest, the natural world. And the idea of being with the Sylvania tree spirits, that they're based, if you like, on Greek dryads. And so the spirit of a tree... They're both the tree and they're separate from the tree, but they are the tree. And if they choose to leave that sort of spirit life and become married to a human, they take on a substantial form of a young woman who is the same age as whatever age her tree is when it matures, so depending on the species of the tree.
Right. Would you like to read us a passage from the first book, The Greening?
I've chosen one from when Fabian he's 16 years old. In this society, young people become adults on their 17th birth anniversary. And he's coming up to that age. And he's quite obsessed with the Sylvani, and he knows quite a lot about them. Now, Fabian is he's the heir to the what's called a holding, which is an area of the country. There's about 10 of these holdings under a ruling prince. So this is just on one occasion. He's gone to talk to his tutor about the Sylvani, and he's just left there, and he's going into town. After Fabian left his tutor's residence, he strolled into the town centre, stopping for a few moments near the fish market to watch a fire dancer, and then moving on down a twisting side street toward the municipal centre, pausing to listen to an itinerant philosopher at the corner of the main square. Throughout the town, already festooned with spring greenery in honour of the season, entertainers were gathering for the forthcoming festival 2 days hence. Fabian knew every twist and turn, every pale yellow stone building, every statue and fountain of the haphazard town, which had been built and developed over many years in proportion to the holding's wealth and prestige. He had no particular purpose as he wandered, though he hoped to meet someone who might find him a distraction for the remainder of the day. By chance, he met Masgor's other students coming out of the court, among them a wiry young man with a mop of brown hair. Nalio was a year older than Fabian and his closest friend. "Did I miss anything?" Fabian asked, with little expectation that he had. "As a matter of fact, you did." Nalio's eyes were bright with excitement. A silk mercer was brought before the court. His goat cart had overturned as he set out for Southernport, and when some other traders stopped to aid him, they discovered a bag of amber hidden among the silks, several dozen small pieces, for which he had no license. What? Fabian demanded. It's true, and he's a local man, apparently, Nalio insisted. Who was sitting? Fabian began to regret that he had not gone along. Your uncle Tarazan. He was not impressed with the mercer's defence that he had no idea what was in the package. You should have been there, Fabian. You should have seen him squirm. Fabian sighed and pulled a wry face. Ah, but he was just a pawn, wasn't he? Whoever's behind this outrage will be at best annoyed at having lost such a valuable cargo. Nalio was not so easily disheartened. Better than that, surely. If it's one of those petty would-be rulers of Garrick that Masgor insists on telling us about, trying to fund their particular cause, today's events might have seen the end of their quest for power. Maybe, Fabian allowed. Let's hope it had something to do with Garrick anyway. It must have, Nalio was genuinely shocked. No one in Maureen could be behind something like that. It's bad enough that a local trader was involved at all. Selling amber, possibly. Collecting it? Never. In his mind, Fabian could see the amber necklace his mother had rejected that morning. Their tears flow like gold from a well of deep sorrow. Our own are mere water, and dried are forgotten, while tears of gold linger and last and endure forever, and then one day more and one more, he recited. Nalio snorted derisively. Well, it's good to know Deep Bell is in capable hands. The heir to the holding can quote at length from the most obscure poetry, but can he remember the date of the last uprising in Garrick or the name of the last Gerrish ambassador to Maureen? No, he cannot. Yes, he can, Fabian murmured. After the rollicking I got from Masgor yesterday, those two facts were inscribed on my mind for all time, believe me. Daydreaming again, Fabian. Nalio mimicked their tutor perfectly. He flung his arm around Fabian's shoulders. Never mind, you only got a rap across the knuckles. Our friend in today's trial had his silk trading license revoked, so he's lost his livelihood, and he was fined, and the court imposed 2 years extra service on him, hard service at that, in the clay pits.
Your writing is really poetic. Is that deliberate, or is it just an extension of yourself?
I'm not sure it's deliberate, so much as, again, probably a reflection on my reading habits. I say I'm a huge Tolkien fan, but my introduction to Tolkien was his poetry rather than any of his books. I've always loved poetry. I loved Shelley and Keats and that sort of poetry. My mother and I used to read them to each other. I used to write bad poetry. I mean, the lovely thing about writing poetry in this book is I can write half a poem, which I'm very good at, and then I get stuck. And I can write half a poem here, and I can leave it at half a poem because I can have a character forgetting what the next line is. That's when I can't make up the next line. Or I can write one verse and not sure where it goes to next. So, yes, I'd say I don't think it's so much deliberate as more of unconscious what's coming out of me. And I loved Homer. I think of the Iliad and the Odyssey, which are poems. So...
Right. Now, one thing that intrigues me in fantasy novels is the wonderful names like Ravik, Fabian, Cassandra.
Cassandra,
sorry, that you can't pronounce, but they just look beautifully written. Where do they come from? Do you just make them up, or do they have some root in mythology or folklore?
Some words are based on another language. So in the second book, one of the Sylvani is called Taxiana, which is from the Latin for yew tree. She's a yew Sylvana, which is giving a bit away because yews are poisonous and they're the baddies, if you like, among the Sylvani. So some words, there's another called Dulcissa, which is, again, based on a root of what is it, dulcimer, is the same, soft tones and things. So some are... There's often a word behind them. Others just come to me. I daydreamed this story, and Fabian was always called Fabian. I'm not sure where that name came from, but he was always him, and he's very real to me. So he wasn't about to have a name change ever. So yes.
Right. What are you working on at the moment?
Another one of these, which was never intended to be. It was finished, as far as I was concerned. The end was left slightly up in the air, but not in any major way. I was perfectly happy to leave people wondering what happened to the other characters. And just over a year ago, I suddenly knew that there was another story and what happened next, and I was quite excited about that. So that is happening. I'm also working, I have, on what I call my Millennium Project, which tells you exactly how old it is, which is quite embarrassing. Back in, at the turn of the Millennium turn, back when I was living in Ireland, I started working on an idea. It actually started off as a film script, but that we ended up doing a different film script for the theatre company. But it's based on folklore, and it's a more contemporary. It happens in this world, but with the connection to the world of the Fae, the other world, largely based on Irish folklore, though a little bit of British folklore as well. And that I'm hoping is going to see the light of day soon. It wasn't that it took me a long time to write. The beginning's fine, the end's fine, and there's bits in the middle that are fine. But it turned into, like most of my books, turned into a bit of an octopus with arms going in so many directions. And because it's more of a young adult story, it needs to be simpler. And I couldn't rein it in, so I sort of put it away. But I've met someone who might be able to sort of at least make me sit down and organise that. So I'd love to finish that, because I'm quite excited by the characters in that. And I'm also working... With a shortish story I finished, but with a local artist, we're trying to finish a project which is based on a rewrite of Genesis, the first few chapters, because I think God needs a bit of PR around that one. So it was inspired by Terry Pratchett and his concept of the wrong trouser leg of time. It's a sort of what if Eve hadn't taken a bite.
But the song you've chosen today is?
Fairport Convention's Tamlin.
Because?
Because I've always loved songs that tell a story. And this is the ultimate telling a story, because this is the folk story of Tamlin, who was taken by the fairies, Fairy Queen, and was possibly going to be given as the fairy tithe to hell. And fell in love with the mortal woman who saved him, set to music. So it's a wonderful folk story that's set to music.
Right, let's listen to Fairport Convention.
I forbid you maidens all that wear gold in your hair to travel to Carter Hall.
Thank you. little green, a bitter botany, and she's gone to Carter Hall as fast as go can she. Oh, tell to me, Tamlin, she said, why came you here to dwell? The Queen of Fairies called me.
Belinda, so much for being with us today. Now, your books are available from...
any local bookshop can, I think Page and Blackmore certainly have them. They're also available through my website. Just look up Belinda Mella Silvana. And the ebooks are available through Amazon and all the other Smashwords and things.
Thank you so much. I'm Galen Pound, and you've been listening to Top Writers. This is the last program in this series, but we will hopefully be back with you in the near future. A podcast of this and previous programs, upcoming events, and information about Top Writers can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Cheers, New Zealand On Air.